Gettysburg Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast. Conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more. With voices from around the corner and around the globe.
Laughing and crying in silence. Our guest today is Father Lawrence Rekla, who is priest in charge at St. Francis Episcopal Church in Bushnell, Florida, but who on 9/11 was present in New York City as part of the recovery operations after the buildings came down, and served as a chaplain in that phase all the way until June of the next year. Father Rekla, tell us exactly what kind of work you were doing, and it's the kind of work that we don't very often hear about because we're mostly involved and very interested in what actually happened in the rescue operations immediately, but then there's 6 months of recovery, and that's right. When chaplains came into play.
Well, chaplains were involved soon on scene. Excuse me. Chaplains were assigned to the temporary morgue. The temporary morgue was on site inside the armed perimeter. The temporary morgue moved three times as operations continued. From the first day, you had a large perimeter, and then that shrunk as we gained control of the area. Whenever anything came into the temporary morgue, any remains, the primary function of temporary morgue was to make a determination whether or not what was recovered, was it human? If the answer is yes, and the preponderance was yes, then that would be transported to D-Mort, Disaster Morgue, at Bellevue. Early on, we had forensic anthropologists there. Again, remember, each of the towers had its own zip code. That's the size we're talking about. How many restaurants do you imagine are in there? Okay, now, what are you recovering? That's what they were there for. Whenever on scene in the site, something was thought to be human remains. Body bag, sometimes the chaplain would be dispatched on scene. More often would remain in the morgue. When the bag is opened on table, a blessing would be made. The ME would make a determination, bag back, and then sent on. If a member of service, and we could tell a member of service based if there were a badge, a weapon, or that kind of thing, then a flag would be done and there would be an escort from there to the disaster morgue.
An escort involving an ambulance, a fire truck?
Right. Ambulance would be the transport vehicle most of the time. NYPD would provide the escort, sometimes state troopers. If it were fire, then often, not always, an apparatus from that house would come and be part of the procession that would go up.
Theoretically, you were not to know, or you were not to discuss who was in that body bag, because I imagine you couldn't be absolutely sure.
In varying degrees. In the time that I was there, I never, ever had a complete body. Now, if one had substantial and an ID, a turnout jacket, an identification, then one would know, and that's how member of service would be done. Then you'd have a clue.
And it's within that context that I want to remind our listeners of why I use the phrase to begin as our theme, laughing and crying in silence, because you told in a public speech I heard today, it happened to be a sermon, that was the kind of the attitude when you were riding in the ambulance with, I think, firefighters.
Right.
You kind of knew who was in the bag. You all did, but
We knew for a fact at that point. And we waited until members of his house, his fire station, came. And then inside the ambulance, I rode with them. And as we're riding along, we're talking about the gentleman laughing about some stories, sometimes silent, sometimes crying. One of three things that came out of the experience there. One statement was, you never trust a man who can't cry. Mm-hmm. Now, from these kind of people, these are about as macho as you get. One of the other lines was, I never met anybody who on their deathbed said, oh, if I had only spent one more day at work. And the third, and this one generally in my experience with uniforms, was something can be important and not urgent. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you've got the time and you use it. If you don't have the time, then you go fast.
Mm. Doing triage at that point would have been a major challenge. So what kind of people are in the morgue when you're working there? Then I want to ask how many hours you had to spend there, but what kind of work is being done in the morgue? Sorting out persons and bodies?
Again, you've got three morgues.
Okay.
You have New York City Morgue, which is Bellevue. At Bellevue, outside the building, you have Disaster Morgue, which receives remains, often unidentified. It's at DMORT that the final determination is made in terms of human or otherwise. Mm-hmm. TMORT basically does the first level of, no, this is not human, we're done, or is, we know, or not sure, DMORT it goes. All of that operation is done under the direct authority of the New York City Medical Examiner. So at the table, it's the Emmy who's running that show. On the pile or in the pit, construction workers are accompanied by generally firefighters who are looking for remains or that kind of thing. If they find, they will then call temporary morgue, and FDNY, Fire Department New York City, EMS, Emergency mm-hmm. Medical Services, will then go on scene, often in a gator. Mm-hmm. That's not a football team. That's a golf court on steroids. And bag and come back to the temporary morgue. If they were involved in an extraction, I remember one that was particularly horrific. They called and wanted me there. And I'm standing there helping me on debris that's moving, standing still, trying to stand still, in a slight drizzle. With that stole that I had on this morning in collar, so that as they're working, they could look up and see, watch the word, through me, not at me, through me, to remember in who and how this is being done.
And this is happening again and again until, did you say
June 2nd, 2002.
And what signaled the end of the process of...
Nothing left
to do. And what was the condition of the buildings at that time?
Gone.
Everything. You were gone. down to the
bedrock. Nothing
to
there.
Bedrock.
Nothing there.
And roughly how many people came through these morgues? Well, something
I have
like
no
3,000. Yeah. You didn't stop to count.
Well, but careful in how you count. Remember when I said I never saw a complete body? Okay?
Yeah.
Now, what that meant was when a family was notified and an identification had been made, to my knowledge, they were given a piece of paper and pleaded with to sign saying, accept this as full and complete notification of finding of remains. Don't make us come back here 10 times. Once is enough. So that there were many a coffin that had test tubes in it. That's it.
For that reason, and this is very delicate, they did not always want your kind of chaplains to talk to families. Do I have that correct?
Yes. Morgue chaplains were explicitly ordered not to deal with families. There were other, and quite frankly, fire department and New York City chaplains dealing with those families. A morgue, a T-mort chaplain's job is primarily to see early on remains, blessings, decorum, decency, and deal with on-site personnel.
Oh, yes.
So if there's nothing happening in the morgue, what I'm doing is then walking around and talking with police, EMS, fire, construction, who's ever around. And when I'd leave the temporary morgue, they'd have my cell phone number so that while I'm out wandering around, they can get me if need be. One of the occasions that I remember well, I went to the morgue always on the subway, right? New York City, who drives?
Sure.
Well, a clerical shirt with a white collar has what's called studs. Never mind, that's what they're called to hold the collar on. Mm-hmm. If the studs are fastened, it feels as though you have the white collar on. I'm riding to the morgue early morning to start a shift. I look at my reflection, no collar. I'm not turning around and going back. Dear Lord, may the chaplain who I'm taking the shift from have a collar. Our Lord has a sense of humor that I not always appreciate. I get there. Here's the good news. Previous chaplain has a collar and is willing to give it to me. Now, this is a wee little Episcopalian lady. Now, how am I going to get this collar to fit? Any male knows. If it's not WD-40, what do you use? Duct tape. That day, I had many a person in hysterics walking around seeing a chaplain in a collar held on with duct tape.
I'm Jerry Christensen, and you're listening to the Seminary Explorers. If there can be gallows humor out of 9/11, we've kind of just heard it. Our guest is the Reverend Father Lawrence Rekla, now of St. Francis Episcopal Church, kind of in retirement. And I don't know if he'd agree with that or not. It's a pretty full-time retirement in Bushnell, Florida, but who was part of the recovery operation as a chaplain on 9/11. How did you get into this in the first place, Larry? What was your connection? You were pastoring, obviously, in New York City, but so are a lot of other people. What was your connection?
Well, the first disaster I worked was Three Mile Island for Red Cross.
Oh, when you were here in Pennsylvania?
That's correct. Oh. Now, that wasn't as a chaplain. I was drafted in charge of all the evacuation shelters in Lancaster County, which, thank you, Jesus, were never needed. But that was my initial contact with Red Cross. When I was in Colorado Springs, I began work then as a volunteer police chaplain with the Colorado Springs Police Department. And when I was on call, chaplain had my very own car. When I went to Utah, I was designated chaplain for two very small departments, taught classes to any number of officers in death notification, and was the division for the Intermountain Division of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. I was an FBI chaplain, trained at Quantico, with primary responsibility with FBI SWAT team. So I have been around cops for quite some time. Then when I went to New York City, I was in Queens. The particular place is called Long Island City. I don't say Long Island City. I say Long Island City. I see people's eyes. They go to a seagull and a lighthouse. That ain't it.
No.
I tell them Astoria. Listen, it's the second stop on the R. So that when this went down, to coin a phrase, and had settled with people in the parish. I mean, I'm called as the pastor of that parish. And there, by the way, United Airlines and American Airlines had their service for their people in the parish I served, September 25th. And after that was relatively taken care of, then I went to Red Cross and said, can you use an old dog? I was interviewed by a retired Los Angeles detective, took one sniff of me and said, yeah, you've been around cops, and off we went. And so then I did in a month as many as five or six shifts, sometimes as few as three, but from that point on all the way up through June, so that without chain of command, just in terms of time, I would have been senior chaplain.
An old friend of yours and mine, Paul Schweinler, Pastor Father Paul Schweinler, who had interviewed twice on the show before it morphed into the current form of podcasting, was himself a chaplain to those who were first on scene, you know, to the caregivers. And I'm thinking about things he observed that that those who are there to help out experience their own form of trauma. They're not automatons. They're not machines. They're human beings. And you're walking around among these people who've been doing this work, this awful work, and they must have had some of the issues to resolve themselves. Were there any common themes among the people who were the first responders, and then also those who were still there doing the digging and the shoveling afterwards?
Gail Sheehy of, what's the name of the book, interviewed and had remarked about she expected to see people complete wrecks, and that was not the experience. We knew that what we were doing was a necessary, noble, and edifying work. And we would take care of one another. One of the themes for all of us was there are some parts of this that you talk to only to people who have had the exact experience or quite similar, period. For many of us, I mean, people have said, well, did it affect you? And I said, no, didn't affect me at all. Now, didn't affect me at all. That meant that when I was done, I weighed 290 pounds, COPD, hypertensive, pre-diabetic, and had a free ticket for an alcoholic problem. But, again, the secret of the secret has to do with context. We all stand in a line. People to the right have had it better. People to the left have had it worse. Now, you might move in your place in the line, but wherever you are, there are always people who have done more. There are people who have done less. So suck it up, cupcake, and you do what needs to be done.
And you're willing to listen to other people who are facing. I mean, the you don't always talk explicitly about who's in the body bag, but you know that they, too, are suffering in silence in many ways. And just to be able to listen to them talk probably is the best therapy of all.
And share with them. I remember at one point, Carnival Cruise had a special. And I said, well, is that for, that's, someone said, "Is that, are you going on that?" I said, no, it's for recovery people. She looked at me and said, so you think you're chopped liver? So it was good to be with family, taking care of family.
You know, I think you mentioned either here or off when we were before we started recording that often or always, as much as possible, families would have to sign off on remains.
Yes.
Why was that? And I'm going to give you a hint that there has to be closure somewhere, but signing for remains, you know, it's grim as it is.
Well, people wanted to know that their loved one was found and that propers and respect could be done. In the time that I was there, I never saw a complete body. When there was sufficient to provide a definitive identification, a family would be notified and said, please consider this full and complete. There is the possibility that we might conceivably find more remains. Please let this be sufficient.
Good.
And now, again, I wasn't one doing that. This is something that was relayed to me, but it makes sense and it is credible and I report it as true.
In the long run, then, I think the one message we've heard today, among the many, many other things you could say, is not only the thoroughness and the sensitivity with it, but the fact that so much of you who were involved went through this, as your theme was in your sermon today and in this interview, that there was laughter and crying in silence.
Yes.
Father Lawrence has been our guest today. Lawrence Rekla is the pastor, the priest in charge at St. Francis Episcopal Church in Bushnell. But in the 9/11 tragedy and its sequences, right until June of the following year, he was an on-site chaplain in one of its morgues. I'm Jerry Christensen for the Seminary Explorers. Thank you for listening. Have a very good day.
You have been listening to the Seminary Explorers from historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, a production of Gettysburg Seminary. We invite you to visit our website at www.ltsg.edu. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of Gettysburg Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.